I'm Tess Vigeland. No place embodies the golden years like Sun City, Arizona. The country's first retirement community was built on a dream of cheap, easy living.
When I retired on less than $400 a month, and I bought the most expensive home on this block.
We'll learn how that vision came to be and how it's changed as newcomers arrive with different ideas of work and leisure.
It has never been part of my dream. I don't want to stop. I enjoy what I do.
And we'll ask what retirement means for the next generation.
It's basically a period at somewhere near the end of my life where I'm physically or mentally unable to work.
Plus, how closely are credit card companies watching what you buy? Very.
The people who, for instance, buy premium wild bird seed, it turns out that they very infrequently went bad on their debts.
Really? Bird seed? It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Welcome to the American Dream, where you'll have an even better life than your parents. You'll eventually own your own home. You'll be able to send the kids to college. And one day, you can stop working and simply enjoy your days, right? Right. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
All this week, we're looking at that question of the next American dream. Today, we'll tackle the retirement part, because so many of us are wondering how on earth we're going to be able to afford it and what compromises we might have to make.
Sometimes I miss the sound of children. So you go into the Arby's or the McDonald's out here and there's no children. And it's just full of old people, of which we don't feel we belong yet. But that's because we're still working.
We'll get to that part of it in a bit. But first, did you ever wonder how retirement came to be part of the dream? The creation of Social Security in the 1930s made it possible for people to stop working at a certain age. But the typical retirement picture we all hold in our minds, well, that didn't come along for another couple of decades. It started on a piece of property much like this one in Sun City, Arizona, the nation's first retirement community.
This is unbelievable.
How tall is that?
Oh, 20 feet, 25 feet, 40 plus arms on it.
That's 60-year-old Bill Pearson. We stood in his backyard admiring a cactus that was so photo-ready, I looked around for the howling coyote. Pearson is in charge of Sun City's 50th anniversary celebration, which is coming up on January 1st.
They called it the largest social experiment the country's ever seen when they built Sun City, because it was unlike anything there at the time. And let me just go. Hello. The decals?
He's fielding all kinds of calls about the festivities.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Luann. Bye-bye. It's finally starting to come together.
Yeah. Pearson and his wife moved here 5 years ago from Minnesota, but they were so prepared to live the Sun City retirement dream that they bought the house before they were even old enough to move in. The age restriction here is 55 and up. For them and more than 40,000 other residents, Sun City embodied a vision of retirement that's become almost cliche. Golf carts, chain restaurants advertising early bird specials. And then there are the walls, capital T, capital W, a 6-foot-tall ring around the city that's only missing a moat and drawbridge.
But there's a mentality that exists here that is within these walls, there's a serenity, a peace that people describe as almost a religious experience.
A religious experience without children. Kids can visit for no more than 90 days a year. And without government interference, Sun City is unincorporated. Just as it's been since real estate magnate Del Webb launched the experiment on January 1st, 1960. Almost overnight, Webb's creation changed how Americans viewed the end of their working lives. The early promotional reels for Sun City pushed a new vision of retirement.
I'm not ready for pasture. I've got a lot of living left in me.
Webb is credited by some with coining the phrase the golden years, and he had big dreams for the 7-mile-long, 2-mile-wide strip of desert north of Phoenix. He hoped 10,000 people might attend that opening day. Instead, more than 100,000 streamed in. Sun City, the advertising promised, was not only about age-restricted living, it was affordable.
At home, you'd have to be the town banker, really loaded to enjoy this kind of life. But the truth is, when I retired on less than $400 a month, and I bought the most expensive home on this block.
Today, the Sun City dream lives on in retirees like Pearson and Joan Adair. We met Joan at the Bell Recreation Center gym, where she works out each morning. She's 74, going on what looks like 64, with eyes that match her turquoise shirt and eyeshadow.
The living here is very inexpensive compared to where I came from. I retired from California, and I knew that when I did retire, I was not going to be able to live there.
Adair lives off a pension and Social Security. Her Sun City condo costs about $500 a month, a quarter of what she paid to park a mobile home in Southern California. And for about $400 a year, she can access all kinds of activities, from swimming to shuffleboard to computer classes and karaoke.
It's been great. I love it.
Are they your golden years?
Yes, they are. Absolutely. I often wonder how I ever worked. I have to admit, I do get tired of the old people. I don't count myself as part of that, but I think I'm young thinking. And frankly, I wish that the age would be lowered to maybe age 50.
But if they lowered the age limit, would people come? Is this the retirement ideal for future generations? Bill Pearson, the 50th anniversary organizer, believes it will be.
Come on. Yeah, what? Did you get to go for a ride in the car?
The Pearsons and their two dogs, Phoenix and Sedona, live in an expansive adobe-style house with walls painted every color under the desert sun. As with Joan Adair, Sun City's relatively low cost was a big attraction for them. And Pearson believes communities like this may find themselves in even greater demand as baby boomers worry about their retirement savings.
The American dream, retirement, it's elusive for a lot of people these days because defined benefit plans are going away, because so many people are seeing that nest egg that they put away, they're having to live off of it, they lose their job. So a lot of folks are saying, hey, we can't retire. The 50th is our chance to show people that like this kind of lifestyle, simpler way to live, a cheaper way to live.
But that lifestyle also assumes a traditional retirement, meaning you're no longer working. And you can participate in what Sun Cityites tout is their volunteer-based community. Well, that picture, the picture that launched a million retirement dreams over the last decades, is already blurring. And that, says Pearson, is the biggest fear of all.
The key to Sun City's future, the next 50 years, is really embedded in our ability to cling to our past. This is a collective setting. Unfortunately, as people move here, they're all too often having to work.
And that's not the American dream Del Webb envisioned. Later in the show, we'll talk to a couple from Michigan who moved to Sun City purely for financial reasons. They say they reside within the walls, but they don't live there. Up next, a chat inside the city's Historical Society about its contributions to the mythology of retirement.
Hear you say life's taking you nowhere.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So over the last 50 years, Sun City definitely created a vivid picture of retirement, but it may not be a vision that lasts for another 50. Kevin McHugh teaches cultural geography at Arizona State, and he's studied the Sun City model. I thought he might have some perspective on its future, and so we met up at a place where it all began.
Thanks for having me.
So we're sitting here in the original living room of the first model home in Sun City. What did the creation of Sun City signal for the whole idea of retirement?
It signaled the fact that retirement wasn't a period of inevitable decline and decrepitude. That, as you know, if you talk to anybody about the history, people that lived here thought of it as a utopia. It was an idyllic place. And it's a place where everybody was old, so no one was old. I think the sense of belonging in older age is really critical.
Obviously, there are plenty of people who retire outside of a community like this, but how, if at all, is Sun City emblematic of the notion of retirement as part of the American dream, that it's something that you should and will be able to attain in your lifetime?
People just assume that if you worked hard and you paid your dues and you saved, that you'd have this little slice of the American dream upon retirement. But of course, financial uncertainties, especially lately, have sort of rocked the dream. So much of our rhetoric and discussion of retirement communities goes back to the early Sun City and the first generation and a lot of the mythology. But now there's other generations coming through.
Then what do you think retirement looks like going forward? Is a place like Sun City part of the next generation's notion of retirement?
Well, first of all, retirement communities are being populated by people that continue to work or work part-time, so it's not as if it's an abrupt end to your career or your involvement in work. I think a lot of this reflects changing cultural attitudes and ideals about aging. In a society that adulates midlife and the continuation of midlife, I don't think we're about to really sanction places for old people. And so the language is shifting to reflect these cultural ideals.
But so what is that language then? I mean, give us an example of that shift.
Well, the shift is we don't use words like retirement communities. The shift is that Del Webb markets communities without the Sun City appellation, without the Sun City name, and they're smaller lifestyle niche communities. And they're geared to lifestyle, not to age segregation. These communities attract a lot of empty nesters, people in late middle age, early retirees, but they're not marketed nor thought of as retirement communities.
How much of it, if any, has to do with concerns over being able to afford the kind of retirement that our parents and grandparents have been able to do?
Well, that's obviously a concern, and you can talk to economists about this, and they'll tell you about savings, and people aren't saving. And in fact, this retirement community phenomenon was always a slice of retirees. It was never a big slice. It loomed large in the American psyche, but it really wasn't a large slice of the American populace. I just think that the official sanction of age-segregated communities is going to go away, and not the fact that older people won't congregate, because there's a lot of advantages people feel for staying in the same place. Their social networks and attachments to place that aren't easily severed. So I think this idea of aging in place is going to become more important in the future.
Kevin McHugh, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Kevin McHugh teaches cultural geography at Arizona State. Affordable homes and low taxes were part of Del Webb's vision for retirement, but those things have lots of appeal beyond retirees.
There are people that are moving into Sun City because it's cleaner, quieter, cheaper.
We'll profile the new face of retirement communities coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
We'll be right back.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. We're spending some time this hour on the American dream of retirement and how it might be changing. But you know what? Americans aren't the only ones who dream of a day when they can stop working. And we wanted to get a sense of how other countries do it. Germans have long enjoyed the guarantee of a government-backed retirement. Marketplace's European Bureau Chief Stephen Beard traveled to Bavaria to see if their grass is really any greener.
Inside a Munich convention center, a dance exercise instructor puts a dozen sprightly retirees through their paces. The elderly dancers seem in excellent shape, both physically and financially. The venue is a giant expo aimed specifically at wealthy pensioners. A big market in Germany, says Karen Deckenbach of AWO, a non-profit that lobbies on behalf of seniors, among other groups.
Germans that are now 65 and older, they truly receive pensions that are certainly among the highest in the world.
Wolfgang, a 78-year-old former economist, is a case in point. He retired at the age of 60 on a company pension. He gets no retirement income from the state, but has no complaints.
During the past 18 years since I'm retired, I have been at least twice every year to the States, to America, and I've traveled to the Far East. No, I cannot complain.
You've had a pretty good time.
Yes, really.
Wolfgang's pension amounts to two-thirds of his peak gross salary, and it adjusts annually for cost of living increases. He does pay taxes, but also receives good, free health care under a government-sponsored program. With his savings and investments to fall back on, Wolfgang feels totally secure.
Most people would consider this sort of retirement where you have no worries. This is practically, you know, you can hardly be topped, so I consider myself fortunate.
Like the United States, Germany relies on a mix of public and private pension systems that pay out varying amounts based on income and money paid in. Wolfgang is in a small minority of Germans who depend exclusively on company or private pensions. For most Germans, 80% of retirement income comes from the state. Workers typically pay into the public system about 10% of their pre-tax income for every year they're on the job. Employers match their contributions. By comparison, workers in the United States typically pay 7.5% of pre-tax income into Social Security. Employers put in the same amount. Karen Deckenbach says most Germans drawing state pensions are officially classified as living comfortably.
Once you retire, you in general get some 70% of your last net income before you retired. And then as a pensioner, you don't have to pay taxes on that. You have a special form of health insurance. So you're pretty well off.
But expectations are high in Germany. It's clear that many retired people who rely solely on the state pension do not feel well off. Am I satisfied? Asked this man. No, I am not. He retired as an unskilled factory worker on a relatively low wage 2 years ago. He's now 64 and receives about $15,000 a year tax-free from the state.
It's enough to get by on. I'm living in subsidized housing and the rent is very low. If I weren't in a subsidized apartment, I'd have to go and get more from Social Security.
Germans on the whole do get more from the state pension system than American retirees, who receive about 40% of pre-retirement income from Social Security. Still, many here feel the government payments provide only subsistence living at best. Otto Teufel is with ADG, a group campaigning for a big increase in the state pension.
We want to have a fair pension so that we don't have only rent and some bread and some butter on it. We also want to have a little bit more.
You want some jam.
Yeah, and some sausage on the bread.
He wants a 50% hike in the state pension so retirees can go to concerts and take regular vacations. It's not going to happen, however. In fact, within a generation, the state pension is likely to be cut by 50%. Here's the problem. As in the United States, the German public pension system is pay-as-you-go. Today's workers are paying for today's retirees. But the birth rate is declining and people are living longer. At the moment in Germany, there are three workers supporting each retiree. Within 30 years, it'll be down to just one worker for every pensioner. The government is now trying, through tax breaks, to encourage more people to take out private pensions. In a park in Munich, I met this skilled factory worker. He's 55 and he's not looking forward to his retirement.
I don't expect to be getting a lot. I'm not very confident. I have one of the new private pensions. Whether that will be sufficient, I have my doubts.
Although generally they can expect a more comfortable old age than Americans, Germans are notorious worriers, and they're certainly beginning to worry a lot more about their retirement. In Munich, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace Money.
Did you catch that last quote in Stephen's piece? The German who said he doubts those new private pensions will be enough to retire on? Sounds a lot like what you'll hear in this country. In fact, a Gallup poll conducted in April found the majority of working Americans, 52%, doubt they'll have enough money to retire in comfort. Of course, as we told you earlier, that whole concept of the golden years is a fairly new one, and one we owe in large part to Sun City founder Del Webb. So let's head back there for a look at how that vision is already changing. First, a quick take from Bill Pearson about what he's seeing. He's the guy organizing the city's 50th anniversary party.
There are people that are moving into Sun City because it's cleaner, quieter, cheaper.
And not necessarily because of the idyllic image that was promoted in early marketing materials.
You deserve a little peace and quiet. And of course, no kids, no schools, easy on the taxes.
Domenico all over Bryant, trying to bother with those long arms.
The NBA playoffs were on when we visited Craig and Pam McDonald's home in Sun City. It's a two-bedroom ranch-style house they bought in 2006 after moving from Michigan. The newest addition to the family greeted us with a few friendly licks. He's a sleek greyhound who, it just so happens, retired from racing earlier this year.
What's his name?
Al.
Al, hi Al. Hi. Oh.
And so he'll be excited here for about 2 minutes. And then
crash.
They call him the 45-mile-an-hour couch potatoes. They lay around all day long.
Al the Greyhound is the only retiree in the household. So what are the McDonald's doing in Sun City?
We reside here. We don't live here.
Okay, what does Craig mean by that? Well, basically, their house is here in Sun City, but they don't consider themselves part of the retirement community. First of all, they're still working. Pam is 57 and works at the Del Webb Hospital. Craig is 58 and a youth minister for a local church.
God is faithful. He'll not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he'll also provide a way out so that you can stand.
A place like Sun City was never part of the McDonald's retirement plan. Actually, they admit they never had much of a plan. But what they did imagine did not look at all like this.
Sometimes I miss the sound of children. So you go into the Arby's or the McDonald's out here and there's no children. And it's just full of old people, of which we don't feel we belong yet, but that's because we're still working.
Craig, what about financially? Has it always been a part of your plan that eventually you would stop working?
Because I was in ministry, I never had a retirement plan. And she worked at a place where her retirement plan was really minimal. So the notion of golden years, it was going to be more like clay as opposed to golden. From a biblical perspective, I don't see anything in the Bible that says you get to a fixed age and life stops and you get to do whatever you want from that point on.
So if it's not a cushy retirement, what is it that's brought Craig and Pam to Sun City?
We looked at buying a place in town where our kids live and our grandkids live. And we could have purchased a house for the same amount of money, maybe a little bit more. But out here, our property tax is $500 a year. Yeah, you got blue hairs with golf carts, but we'll deal with that.
It's not about the rec centers or the walls or a life of leisure. For the McDonald's, it was all about affordability. And given their lack of financial planning, they're not sure that will ever change.
Actually, I guess I've always thought I'd die with my boots on, so I don't know. Golden years, I don't know.
If we do retire in the classic sense of the term, it will be because of an inheritance.
Do you consider the ability to retire part of the American dream?
It has never been part of my dream. I don't want to stop. I enjoy what I do.
And the more people like them who move in, the more the culture of this retirement community and others like it will change. So perhaps we'll just have to retire the whole notion of retirement.
I want to retire, no longer required. I want to get by without the man on my back. A tear in my eye with a heart full of pride. I must go out on a high and tell my body why.
One thing Craig and Pam mentioned to us in passing was that their children are doing a lot more planning for the future than they ever did. But retirement is far from an obsession.
They're ensuring their financial security. But it's not like there's this carrot out there that they're looking forward to getting to.
So we've asked one of them to join us for the younger generation's perspective. Steve McDonald is Craig and Pam's eldest son. He's 34, married, no kids, and lives in Goodyear, Arizona, about 25 miles from the folks. Welcome to the program, Steve.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity.
So you've just heard what your parents said about your retirement. What do you think of that?
I think that's pretty spot on. For us, it's a matter of making sure we have options available to us when we get to that age, but it's not so much about a specific date or a specific goal, you know, an RV or a vacation home or anything like that. It's far enough down the road, we just want to have as many options available to us as possible.
Do you think that there's been a shift in thinking about retirement?
My generation has to face the fact that Social Security is probably not going to be there for us or in a very different format. And most of us aren't on pensions at this age.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have a specific date that we can say, at this point, I'm done. I've maxed out what I can do. And now it's not worth it for me to work anymore. So we just have to plod along as best we can now, especially after the last couple of years. You have no idea what's going to happen, even to what you have saved already. You know, all it takes is for the stock market to tank, and you could be set back another couple of years.
When you talk about the financial part of preparing for retirement and how that is going to be so different for you than it was for your parents and obviously your grandparents, I wonder, what does retirement mean to you?
Retirement is, I guess it's basically a period at somewhere near the end of my life where either I'm physically or mentally unable to work or just at a point where it's not a driving factor for me anymore. You know, it's a concept that's out there, but it's not well defined.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of when you hear the phrase the golden years?
My parents, you know, I don't even picture that for myself. Golden years for me would be, I guess probably in my 70s and on.
Hmm. So not the kind of ideal 65 that has been for previous generations.
No, you know, what really opened our eyes is we took a class through the city of Goodyear to help us prepare for retirement and understand some of what we have to do. One of the things that hit home there was that our average life expectancy is increasing. And so if you plan on retiring at 55 or 60, you better have enough money that can last you 30 or 40 years.
What, if anything, did you learn from your parents' experience? They told us that they didn't even really start thinking about retirement until they were in their 40s, and you're in your 30s, already well ahead of the game. How did you decide that that was something you needed to start thinking about?
A lot of it came from seeing my parents, and when you're a kid, you think your parents are just going to keep working and doing what they do for forever. But as I become an adult, and I see my parents, and I would love for my parents to be able to say, you know, in 5 years, we're done working and we're going to live life to its fullest and be able to go and do whatever we want. And that option's really not out there in front of them. So I guess mostly seeing that and knowing that I don't want my wife and I to be in the same spot. And really for us, at this point, we've decided not to have kids. So while my parents can count on my brother and I to step in and take care of them should the time ever come, we don't have that option, so we have to be twice as careful in how we save for the future so that whatever comes up physically, we're prepared for it.
You know, one of the things that struck me when we met your parents in Sun City is that they don't really buy into this whole notion of a retirement community, despite the fact that they live in one.
Yeah.
How do you feel about a place like Sun City?
There again, I agree with my parents. To me, it seems to be a little too homogenous. It's, you walk out your front door, you can look left, right, and in front of you and see the same guy in a different pair of plaid shorts, basically. I think I'd prefer to be in an area that's somewhere like I live now. You can have a variety of people around you. It just seems a little too, not gated, but a little too unique and contrary to everything that's going on around it.
Well, Steve McDonald, thank you so much for talking with us. It was a lot of fun to speak with your folks, and I'm glad we got you as well.
Great, I appreciate it.
And you can take a tour of Sun City on our website, marketplace.org. We've got a slideshow with pictures from opening day in 1960 and images of life there now. Plus, you'll find other pieces from our series, The Next American Dream.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. American Public Media presents The Next American Dream. What will it look like? Find out more at nextamericandream.org.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Our economics editor, Chris Farrell, thinks about retirement a lot. He gets questions about it, of course. And he'd like to actually retire himself someday. Here's his assessment of the next American dream for retirement.
The message in the current economic collapse to America's aging population? Forget retirement. That's right. We're going to be working during the last third of life. Put it this way, survey after survey shows that most aging baby boomers want to work in retirement. Well, that wish just got granted. Our image of retirement is still shaped by the early decades after World War II. The poverty rate plunged thanks to Social Security. Older Americans gained universal health care coverage with Medicare. Corporate America offered workers good pensions. And it was in these years that retirees developed a distinct lifestyle, captured by the mass migration to the Sun Belt. Places like Sun City, traveling in RVs, and long mornings spent on the golf course. The rise of modern retirement was a great social achievement of the 20th century. But in the 21st century, the underlying economics of retirement have changed. The risk of getting laid off is high. Healthcare is increasingly expensive. Our pension is now the 401k. And for the second time in 8 years, savers have watched in horror as their retirement money was badly beaten down by a bear market. We've learned that most of us simply can't save enough to create a solid foundation of savings for old age. The solution? Work longer. Fact is, the longer you work, the less you need to save for old age. Pocketing even a small income lets savings compound over a longer period of time. The idea of working longer sounds horrible to anyone who has dreamed of retiring in a place like Sun City. Not all seniors will be physically and mentally healthy in retirement. That said, for most people, the change will be for the good. After all, we're living longer, healthier lives. Work keeps the mind active. It's a community where we have friends and acquaintances. Here's my bet. Instead of talking about retirement, we'll discuss second, third, maybe even fourth careers over a lifetime. The challenge for all of us, employers and employees, entrepreneurs and legislators, is how to make this change an even better vision of old age than life in Sun City in the early post-war years. It won't be easy.
And that was our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Now, sure, credit card companies care whether you pay on time, but who knew they cared how often you check your balance?
Not only how often you check your balance, what time of day you check your balance. Are you checking your balance at, say, 1 in the afternoon when you should be at work?
Yikes, they're logging your log-ons, and then some. That's all coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Thank you.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. I like to think I know a lot about credit cards. I use them. I report on them. But then I read Charles Duhigg's story in this weekend's New York Times Magazine about how card companies use the data from the stuff we're buying. The article is called "What Does Your Credit Card Company Know About You?" And Charles, I guess the simple and kind of terrifying answer to that question is a heck of a lot more than you think.
They might actually know a lot more about you than you know about you.
Tell us what the card companies are looking at and what they're doing with that information. It's really all about what we're buying, right?
Right, right. The card companies about a decade ago became very interested in understanding cardholders and consumers as psychological beings. They've built these massive laboratories where they can track what you buy with your card and sort of deduce a lot of things about you based on those patterns. So for instance, a good example is the study that was done by Canadian Tire in 2002. And mm-hmm. Canadian Tire is a big retailer that sells all types of things. It's like Walmart. What one of the executives there did is he looked at how people were using Canadian Tire credit cards and tracking what products they actually purchased. And he found out that people who, for instance, buy premium wild bird seed, it turns out that they very infrequently went bad on their debts. Whereas people who bought chrome accessories for their car, they walked away from their debts much more frequently.
And the fascinating part of that is what, for example, the bird seed purchase told them.
So if you buy premium wild bird seed, you're spending a lot of money on something that you're going to give away to birds that you don't own.
Right.
They basically figured out that the types of people who do that pay off their credit card on time because they feel this sense of moral obligation.
Jeez. You know, Charles, I hate to think of what they know or think they know about me. You know, based on the fact that, I don't know, in the last week, I think I used my credit card for a charity donation. I think I bought a few T-shirts, a shampoo and haircut for my dog.
Well, see, all of those things might actually say that you're a great bet for the credit card companies. What they're really looking for is they're looking for changes in how someone uses their card and what that says. So, for instance, let's say that you never used your credit card to buy groceries before.
Uh-huh.
And all of a sudden, you start using it in the grocery store. What that's going to say to the credit card company is you're going through a period of financial distress. And so they're going to get on the phone and they're going to try and figure out what's going on with you, Tess. Is there a chance that you're not going to pay off your credit card bill this month? And if you say, yeah, you know, things are shaky at work or I don't have that much money lately, then they're going to start using their psychological profiles to figure out what type of persuasion is going to work best with you. Are you the type of person who needs kind of a tough love and a firm rap on the knuckles? Or do you need someone who's going to offer you a shoulder to cry on?
You know, it's almost like these card companies are anthropologists making field notes. Should any of us be surprised about this, that they're tracking every little thing that we do with our cards?
Absolutely not. And what's interesting is it's not that they're anthropologists because they're much more scientific. The credit card companies are one of the few industries on Earth that get millions and millions of new data points every single day. Anthropologists have to look at, like, you know, fossil records. The credit card companies can run little experiments. They can offer you a new deal next month or give you a certain type of phone call and see how you react.
They're watching for how often I check my balance.
Not only how often you check your balance, what time of day you check your balance. Are you checking your balance at, say, 1 in the afternoon when you should be at work, or 1 in the morning when you might be sleepless because you have anxiety over how much credit card debt you have?
Jeez.
And these techniques that the credit card companies use, where they can get much, much more specific about the creditworthiness of a particular consumer, it lets them analyze much, much better how much credit each person should be given access to.
Charles, there's legislation pending right now to tamp down on some of the more egregious credit industry practices. But after your reporting, what do you think the future of credit cards looks like?
Well, certainly the future of the industry is going to be a more constrained one in the short term. A lot of these things that Congress is pushing through are going to make it much harder for credit card companies to play a lot of the sneaky tricks that have fattened their profits for a number of years, like fees and skyrocketing interest rates. But the other part of how the credit card industry is going to change over the long term is they're going to want to know their customers much, much better before they give you a card in the first place. If you have a checking account with Citibank, they're going to want you to have a credit card with them too, and your mortgage. Because the more ways that they touch your financial life, the more data they'll have about you. In the past, it used to be that a company would say, I know nothing about you. I'm going to give you a card, and then I'll figure out 6 months from now how much I should charge you in interest. Now credit card companies are going to have to judge what interest rate they should charge you ahead of time. And so they're going to focus a lot on people that they already have data on, instead of those people who are unknowns.
Well, I was just about to make a snide comment about, you know, Orwell, but I suppose if we're getting ourselves into this stuff, if we want the credit, we got to buy into them knowing everything about us.
The truth of the matter is that there's a price to be paid for everything, unfortunately, and anyone can always opt out of the credit card economy. All you have to do is buy a pair of scissors for $2.
Charles Duhigg is a staff writer for the New York Times. His article in this weekend's Sunday magazine is called, What Does Your Credit Card Company Know About You?
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider, helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
It's time for Getting Personal, when we answer your money questions. And with me, as always, is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
So let's get right to the phones. And David is calling in from Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, David.
Hey, how are you?
We're doing well. And how are you? I understand you have a bit of a long-term question for us. What's on your mind?
Well, I need your help. I am missing a key piece of information or data, if you will, on determining how much life insurance I need for my wife. And it's not something that I like to think about, but now that we have two kids, I feel like avoiding the issue is not really an option either.
Good.
We have our finances pretty well under control. We spend an enormous amount on things like diapers and daycare.
How old are your kids?
6 months and 2.5.
Oh,
both
wow.
Both boys. And, man, that's a whole other question.
And for a different show, I think.
I ciphered out I need to earn $1,000 per child per year just to cover diapers and wipes at
Woo!
This point. You know, that's before tax money.
Of course.
But the thing is, my wife is an attorney, and she's really, really smart. But her student loan payment, I mean, it's like another mortgage. It's well into the six figures is what she borrowed to go to law school. But the thing is she borrowed that money before we were married, but she started her business, you know, after we've been married about a year and a half. And I'm just wondering if her student loan company would or can come after me if, God forbid, something had happened and, you know, she wasn't with us anymore. Because that makes a huge difference on how much life insurance I need to buy.
Yeah, you bet it does. Well, first of all, props for thinking about this in the first place. It's a topic that a lot of people just don't even want to address. Chris, I guess really the question here is, will David be liable, should something happen to his wife, for her student loans, and then that would affect how much life insurance he needs to get?
Well, Tess and David, you're going to love my answer. It all depends. I know, Tess, you hate it when I say that.
Yep.
But if these are government loans, the debt is not an obligation of the estate. If these are private student loans, which my guess is that they are, then it becomes part of the responsibility of the estate, and you're part of that estate.
David, do you know if these are private or government loans?
I think they're half and half.
Okay. So, Chris, what we're really talking about here then is the private loan portion of this debt load.
That's right. So look at the loan terms, look at the actual documents, but just as a general rule, government loans, the obligation dies with the person. Private loans, it becomes part of the estate, just like any other loan that's been taken out, and then the estate continues to pay it.
Wow. That's good to know. I sure do appreciate your help.
Sure. All right, David. Well, good luck, and thanks for calling in.
All right. Well, thank you both. I appreciate it.
All right, Chris, let's reach into the email bag, and Jason writes in from right here in Los Angeles, California, and he's got a sizable chunk of credit card debt, more than $15,000. The interest rate he's paying on that is about 7.5%. But here's his dilemma. A portion of that, $900 worth, was from a cash advance on the card, and the interest rate on that is 20%. Not 7.5%, 20%. So his is a question about why he can't pay off that $900 at 20% first. and then keep paying the rest of the card. But I have a feeling your answer is going to be, you have no choice here. You're going to have to pay it all down, right?
You have to pay it all down. You have no choice. You know, I guess at some level, it's good that the cash advance exists as an emergency. But it's 20 to 25%. And anybody who does it faces the problem that he's dealing with right now. I mean, you can call up the credit card company and say, hey, cut me a deal. But they're not going to. I guess if you were some great customer doing $100,000 a month and they're making all kinds of money, they might cut you a deal. But for most of us, they're going to say, hey, those are the terms of the contract and we're going to enforce it.
And really, the only way to get rid of that 20% interest is to pay it all down 100%, right? Just pay off the entire bill.
Just pay off the entire bill. And you know what, Tess? That comes to be the answer for a lot of our credit card questions. FICO scores. You know, you're worried about it? Pay off the credit card debt. Cash advance? Worried about it? Pay off the credit card debt. You know, in the end, pay off the credit card debt is the right answer to almost all the credit card questions.
Chris, it's always nice when we can have one answer for everything, right? Pay off your credit card debt.
It's wonderful. Yes, it is.
Well, unfortunately, those are all the questions we can take on this week's show. But Chris is now answering your personal finance questions online every weekday. Just visit our website. It's marketplace.org and click on the Getting Personal link. You can also call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Checking in now with Gail George, our Marketplace Money lab rat, who's agreed to track her spending this month and tell us all about it. Hi, Gail.
Hi, how are you, Tess?
I'm good. I suppose I shouldn't be calling any human being a lab rat.
No, that's fine. I work with 30 of them every day.
So how'd it go? I know last week you had a couple of unplanned for expenses, and that made things a little harder. Was it any easier this week?
No, I had more unplanned expenses this week.
Oh, my.
Two tires for my SUV. So, yeah, I was debating whether I should make that a line item in the budget or whether I should just have car maintenance. So it's good. It's like forcing me to sort of think more creatively about how to get the budget working. But I didn't get it on paper. I ended up going out of town and, gosh, I thought, how do people do this when they have to plan this on a regular basis?
Yeah, it is almost an extra job. I mean, especially if you're tracking every penny, that's a lot to remember.
Yeah.
Well, so you're in the home stretch, one more week to go. Any big insights you'd like to share?
Always make sure you budget your public radio membership.
I like that one. Good one. Everybody needs to remember that one.
I thought that might work for you. Make sure that you've got your emergency expenses. I think I'm going to try and go for 4 months of emergency expenses. I know at its best from listening to your show a lot that 4 to 6 months they really would like you to have saved. But I think in the beginning, if I could just go with 4 months.
Hey, if that's going to make it so that you can actually do it and feel good about it, I think both Chris Farrell and I would agree with that.
Well, good.
Well, last week you agreed with our suggestion that you try to do some of this tracking on a computer instead of a pen and paper. Did that work for you?
It will work for me. It did not work this past week. I think I will get to it this week for sure.
All right. We'll look forward to that. Gail George, nice to talk to you again.
Thank you so much, Tess.
We talk a lot on this program about debt, managing it, worrying about your FICO score. But what if you just didn't have any in the first place?
Welcome to the Dave Ramsey Show, where debt is dumb, cash is king, and the paid-off home mortgage has taken the place of the BMW as the status symbol of choice.
Personal finance guru Dave Ramsey believes all debt is bad debt. And we know some of you follow Dave's advice because you write in and tell us to. Well, we're going to talk to him in a few days about that and all kinds of other things. If you're a Ramsey follower, tell us why and whether it's worked. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact. Meanwhile, if you're out on the town for dinner this weekend and you run into a group of teenagers dressed to the nines and all a Twitter, in the old-fashioned sense of the word, chances are good they're heading to the prom. But the recession is making even this traditionally carefree group think more sensibly about the big night. Andrea Gardner chatted with some Burbank High School seniors about their plans.
This feels like a different year.
Yeah.
It does. Yeah.
That's for sure.
Last year at this time, people weren't watching every dollar they spent like they are now.
You know, people like suffering and losing their jobs, it shows.
That's Amada Martinez and Cassandra Alamaraz. In the past few years, kids like them at Burbank High School threw lavish Sweet 16 parties and talked their parents into designer handbags they couldn't afford. This year, money is tight. Parents can't pay for prom outright. More students have after-school jobs. Jacqueline Ontiveros and Laura Saikali say they're chipping in their paychecks and looking for deals.
I went to, like, a discount store. It's the same brand dress. It's just, I guess it's, like, out of style or whatever, but I think it's fine.
My dress, I basically ordered online. It's $97. I got the shorter dress because it was less expensive than all the other long ones. One of my friends, she had to borrow a dress from another friend of ours. Her parents are laid off, too, and they can't really pay for much.
For the guys who bought their tickets, the big expense is the tux. It runs around $120 to rent. Then there's the limo. It runs $400. If you can afford it, it's just you and your date in the back seat. This year, most kids are splitting it with the largest group possible. Senior Anthony Santa says he's jealous of his friend's prom last year.
Full on board with like a Hummer limo and the most expensive tux they could find. But now that my friends have gone to college and now it's my turn, I'm starting to really feel the impact of not being able to go full on overboard. I mean, as much as I want to, I can't really.
Ordinarily, these kids say they might spend $500 total on prom. Now they're trying to bring the bill in around 300. There's a lot more do-it-yourself in the picture.
Self-tan, spray tan, or if they have a friend that knows a friend that can do their nails for a cheaper price, I mean, that's how it is.
My friends and I aren't even taking limos. We're going to drive ourselves.
I'm doing all my friends' makeups, and we're all kind of trading stuff back and forth.
If they wanted to borrow money for the dream night, a local credit union is offering $500 prom loans. No one in this group wanted the debt. They said they'd rather be frugal, but that frugal mentality only goes so far. These are teenagers, after all. There are certain things they won't give up, like the after party, where students pool their money to rent a private beach house or hotel room. That adds about $100 to the tab.
What percentage of your friends do you think are doing one of these hotels or beach house things?
A lot of them.
Either Palm Springs, a hotel, or a beach house.
Here's their rationale. Do prom on the cheap. After all, it only lasts 3 hours. Then there might be money left over for a celebration that lasts all weekend. In Los Angeles, I'm Andrea Gardner for Marketplace Money.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Oh, I love this movie. Next time, believe it or not, it's a great time to buy a car. And yes, Virginia, you can get financing.
For a little while, you had to have like a 730 credit score, so virtually nobody was getting it. They dropped it, so people in the mid-600s are getting cars now.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troe. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.